Hi friends, I am your host Jade, and welcome or welcome back to Criminal Curiosity, the true crime podcast that dives into bizarre and fascinating cases. Together we talk about everything in the true crime world, whether you've heard of them or not. So buckle up and get ready to feed your curiosity with Criminal Curiosity. This week we're going to be talking about serial killer Carl Watts, who murdered women in different states over an 8-year time period. So let's get started. This case is also a very long one, so stick with me on this. And I think this is the third case that has taken place in Michigan, which definitely was not planned, but next week's episode definitely won't be in Michigan. So probably an M state or something, but not Michigan. Carl Eugene Watts was born on November 5th, 1953 to his parents Richard Watts and Dorothy Young in Killen, Texas. His mother taught kindergarten art and his father served in the military as a private first class. Richard Watts was moved to Killen, Texas, Fort Hood. The family relocated to West Virginia 3 days after Carl was born, and a year later the couple welcomed Sharon Watts, their second child. Carl's mother was left to raise him after his parents split up, approximately 2 years after Carl was born. Dorothy, the mother of Carl, married a mechanic named Norman Caesar in 1962, and he had 2 daughters from a previous marriage. The family moved to Inkster, Michigan, where Dorothy was working as a high school art teacher. There was a lot of tension since Carl was having a hard time adjusting to his stepfather. Dorothy Young would visit her family in Colwood, West Virginia, where she was born, and she would bring the children when she went to visit, and that is where Carl learned to hunt and skin rabbits with his grandfather, and this was something that he enjoyed. And Carl's nickname was Coral because of how his family pronounced his name. But we aren't calling him Coral in this story because every time I think of Coral, I'm thinking of a woman, not a man that is a serial killer. Carl wasn't the best in school, but, you know, he made it through. He and his sister contracted meningitis when he was 8 years old, and this pretty much nearly killed him. Now, meningitis is a rare infection that causes inflammation in the brain and the spinal cord, and you get meningitis from bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites. Carl had to repeat the second grade because of the amount of school that he missed due to having meningitis. Carl was brought to the Herman Kiefer Hospital in Detroit, Michigan, where he had to undergo spinal taps. There were some reports that stated that his body temperature was so high that it might have caused brain damage. Yes, while his temperature might have been very high, we're not going to say that that's the reason he's a serial killer. His family claims that once he recovered, he was a changed person. He was much more quieter and much more reserved. He had a considerably low attention span and had trouble remembering things. And as a result of being ill, he was always exhausted when he returned to school. Carl began to experience violent dreams in which he killed the evil spirits of women, and as a result, he, of course, was not able to fall asleep. Carl claims that he started having these thoughts of torturing and killing girls and women when he was 12 years old. Police believe he was stalking girls to fulfill his fantasies around the time he killed his first victim, which they believe occurred when he was 15 years old. Carl was failing in every single subject in school and could only read at a fourth grade level when he was 16 years old. Given that his mother is a teacher and that he is illiterate for his age, he, you know, should have been reading them books instead of having these violent thoughts about killing girls and women. On June 26, 1969, Carl knocked on the door of Joanne Gave, who was 26 years old, while he was distributing newspapers. When she opened the door, he punched her in the face and kept doing so until she cried out. He walked away, then delivered newspapers as if nothing happened. He was taken into custody by police 4 days later when they visited his home. When they ask him, you know, why did you beat up this woman, he says, "I just felt like beating someone up." Carl was ordered to undergo psychiatric treatment at the Lafayette Mental Clinic in Detroit. He was asked about his violent dreams during the evaluation, claimed that he always felt better after having one of those dreams and that, you know, they're not nightmares to him because he enjoys them. An evaluation revealed Carl had an IQ of 75 and a mild intellectual disability. According to Dr. Gary Ainsworth, he states, quote, a paranoid young man who is struggling for control of strong homicidal impulses. His behavior controls are faulty, and there is a high potential for violent acting out. This individual is considered dangerous. End quote. The doctor believed that Carl was a threat to society and was sent to outpatient therapy, where he was released on November 7, 1996, on his 16th birthday. Carl visited the facility roughly 10 times for outpatient care throughout the following 5 years. Carl received a football scholarship at Lane College in Jackson, Tennessee, where he graduated high school at the age of 19 in 1973. According to one report, he was charged with stalking and assaulting women after 3 months and suffered a knee injury, so he left college. Another source states that he suffered a knee injury and just dropped out of college. However, he stopped going to college completely and returned to Michigan, where he spent a year working as a mechanic for a wheel manufacturer. Carl began studying engineering in 1974 at the Kalamazoo Western Michigan University. Carl returned to college and did nothing, essentially. He became less and less interested in classes and started playing ping pong or just lounging around, which gave him plenty of time and opportunity to reflect on his sinister fantasies. Carl would kill white women between the ages of 14 and 44 in various cities and states, and he would use various methods such as strangulation, bludgeoning, drowning, and stabbing. Carl knocks on the door of Lenore Kizanaki's apartment on October 25, 1974 at 10:45 a.m. Lenore is a 23-year-old university student. Carl knocks on the door, and when she opens it, he asks for his brother, Charles. She states that no one here with that name lives here. He leaves and comes back 10 minutes later, asking the same question. She asks him if he wanted to leave a note for Charles. She removed the chain from the door, and Carl forced his way inside. He choked her until she passed out by placing his knee on her chest and his hands around her throat. 19-year-old Gloria Steele was a mother and a student at the university. She was discovered dead in her apartment on October 30, 1974. She had a crushed windpipe and had been stabbed 33 times in the chest. A wooden carving tool that was buried in her spine was used as a murder weapon. No indication of a robbery or a sexual assault were present in any of these murders. Only one witness saw a black man heading up the stairs and knocking on the door saying, "I'm looking for Charles." 23-year-old Diane Williams saw a black man walking around her apartment on November 12th. The man knocked on her door at 12:12 p.m. and asked if she knew where Charles was. Diane did the same thing as Lenore. She grabbed a piece of paper so he could write a note down for Charles. He snatches the paper out of her hands and pushed the door open. He then grabbed her by her throat and dragged her into the living room. The phone starts ringing as Diane was fending off her attacker, but she was able to knock it off the hook and scream for help. Carl started to panic and ran off. Diane quickly rushes to the window where she saw the man get in a brown Pontiac Grand Prix and leave. When she called the police, they set up a lineup of 8 black men who were all driving the same car. Diane and Lenore picked Carl Watts out of the lineup. Carl was arrested on November 16th and accused of assault and robbery, and was accused of assault and battery against Gloria and Lenore. When questioned about Gloria's murder, Carl stated that he was in the area of the apartments but denied having anything to do with her murder. Carl then comes forward about attacking 15 additional women. Detroit police issued a search warrant for Carl's home on December 12th. They discovered carving tools there, but nothing that would have linked them to Gloria's murder. Carl pleaded no contest to the attack on Diane and Lenore and was sentenced to 1 year in prison. But the story does not end there. 8 months later, after his release from prison, Carl Watts returned to Inkster to live with his mother and stepfather. Carl met up with a childhood friend named Dolores Howard, and pretty quickly she would be expecting her first child with Carl. On February 3, 1979, Carl's daughter, Nakisha Watts, was born. Carl soon denied being the father of the child and left Dolores and his daughter. Dolores requested that Carl pay her $70 a week in child support, and the judge agreed, finding that Carl was the father. Carl met Valeria Goodwill, and they got married on August 17th, 1979. After the wedding, Valeria claimed that Carl started behaving strangely, and that she would frequently wake up in the middle of the night, horrified to find that Carl was in a fistfight in his sleep. Carl admitted to Valeria that he had been fighting in his dreams as a result of anxiety about work. Carl's behavior again started to change. He would dump trash on the floor, he would destroy the houseplants with a kitchen knife, and he would melt pieces of the candlestick into the kitchen table. Carl had a habit of leaving the house in the middle of the night and returning with his clothes ripped. So pretty quickly, the marriage ended after 6 months. On September 21st, 1979, 34-year-old Malak Haddad, also known as Mimi's decapitated body, was found in Allen Park in Detroit, and her head was never found. On October 2nd, 1979, 20-year-old Don Jerome was found strangled to death in Taylor, Michigan, about 18 miles from Detroit. 22-year-old Peggy Pochmara was found strangled to death in Detroit in the neighbor's front yard. 44-year-old Jean Klein was stabbed 13 times on October 31, 1979, in front of her home in Detroit's northeastern area. Children were out trick-or-treating on the day of the murder because it was Halloween, and when they came across her body, you know, they're kids, they just assumed that it was decorations. 36-year-old Helen May Dutcher was stabbed 12 times in the neck and back on December 1, 1979, outside a dry cleaner. An individual who witnessed the murder was able to provide a composite sketch of the person who resembled Carl. On March 10, 1980, 23-year-old Hazel Conniff was found in the driveway of her boyfriend's home, where she was tied to a chain-link fence with a belt around her neck. On March 31, 1980, 26-year-old Denise Dunmore was found strangled to death in a Detroit parking lot at 4:15 a.m. On April 20th, 1980, 17-year-old Shirley Small was found on the sidewalk only 70 feet from her family home in Ann Arbor, Michigan at 6:54 a.m. She was stabbed in the heart between the second and third rib with a scalpel-like instrument. She also had 6 slices on her face and 1 on her upper lip. Her purse was on the ground next to her, but nothing was taken. Only 4 blocks from where Hazel Conniff was discovered, 23-year-old Linda Monterio was discovered strangled to death outside her Detroit house on May 31, 1980. On July 13, 1980, 26-year-old Glenda Richmond was found dead 27 feet from her apartment in Ann Arbor. She was stabbed 28 times in the left breast with a screwdriver. On July 31, 1980, 22-year-old Irene Kondradowicz was grabbed from behind by a man who slashed her throat at around 3:43 a.m. in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. She survived the attack but wasn't able to identify the man. At 4:15 a.m., a 1978 Brown Grand Prix was photographed crossing the border from Windsor into Michigan by U.S. Customs. On September 14, 1980, Rebecca Huff was found dead outside her apartment in Ann Arbor. She was stabbed 44 times with a screwdriver. Police started to suspect that the same individual might be behind all of these killings around this time. All of the victims were white women who were killed on Sunday morning, early hours outside their homes. The serial killer quickly earned the moniker the Sunday Morning Slasher when the 16-year-old boy was delivering newspapers. He spoke with the police in Ann Arbor and informed them of Carl Watts. On October 6, 1980, 20-year-old Sandra Dolpe was attacked and stabbed in Windsor, Ontario, and survived. She states that she was walking home from night school and was just 2 houses away from where she lived when she heard footsteps behind her. Sandra was stabbed in the back, and the knife went through her left shoulder blade. She ended up getting 2 broken ribs, a punctured lung, she got a 4-inch cut on the right side of her neck, a 2-inch stab wound on her left shoulder, and 2 large slices across her face from her mouth to her ear. Sandra's spinal nerve and facial nerve were severed. She became paralyzed in many of her muscles, making it harder to eat, raise her arms, or move her head. She told investigators that she had seen the man who attacked her earlier that day at the bus stop, sitting in a brown car in front of the school. Again, the U.S. Customs photographed a Brown Grand Prix crossing the U.S.-Canadian border at 2:15 a.m. 33-year-old Mary Angus returned home from a Halloween party in Windsor, Ontario, at 4:30 in the morning on November 1, 1980. She saw a black man in a hoodie when she stepped out of the car. She walked to the front door, picked up her keys, and watched him. The man pretended to be tying his shoes before abruptly taking off to chase after Mary. The man fled after being startled by her screams. After calling the police, Mary was able to identify Carl Watts as the attacker, thanks to the police's collection of images featuring several other guys. Shortly after the attack at 2:07 a.m., U.S. Customs had records of the same brown Grand Prix vehicle crossing the border from Windsor to Detroit. On November 6, 1980, Lena Bennett, then 63 years old, was discovered hanging from a beam by a trench coat belt in Harper Woods, Michigan, in the garage. Around 5 in the morning on November 15, 1980, two Ann Arbor police officers are on patrol on Main Street when they notice a suspicious man following a woman as she made her way to her car. When she noticed that the man is following her, she hid in the doorway to lose the man, and police notice that the man is going pretty crazy because he couldn't find the woman. Carl is pulled over by police for having a suspended license and a expired license plate. When they examine his car, they discovered screwdrivers, wood carving tools, and a dictionary that belonged to Rebecca Huff, and the words, "Rebecca is a lover," engraved on it. None of these things provided enough proof to police that Carl committed a crime. Carl then arrives in Columbus, Texas in the spring of 1981 and started working at an oil company 73 miles outside of Houston. He would drive his brown Grand Prix back and forth to Houston on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, which were his days off. On September 5, 1981, while driving through Houston, Carl noticed 22-year-old Linda Tilley sitting in her vehicle. He followed her 160 miles back to her apartment in Austin, Texas. Once inside the apartment complex, he followed her and grabbed her from behind. Linda was struggling and they both ended up in the swimming pool. Carl held her underwater until she drowned and then left. Detectives reported that there were no bruises, there were no cuts, there were no indication that there was a struggle. She had alcohol in her system, according to the toxicology report, which led them to conclude that she was intoxicated when she accidentally fell into the pool and drowned. 25-year-old Elizabeth Montgomery was fatally stabbed in the chest on September 12, 1981, while she was walking her dogs outside her Houston apartment. The next day, on September 13, 1981, 21-year-old Susan Wolfe walked less than 3 miles from the Safeway grocery store to where Elizabeth was murdered. Carl was following her and waited. She left the grocery store at 1:40 a.m. with ice cream, Oreos, milk, and cigarettes. She drove to her apartment and walked up the stairs where Carl snuck up behind her and stabbed her 9 times in the arm and chest. Carl later got another job in Houston as a mechanic, working from 7 p.m. until 3 a.m. Therefore, he relocated to Houston from Columbus. 27-year-old Ellen Tam was jogging early on January 4, 1982. At approximately 7:45 a.m., someone was walking by when they discovered her body. 4 feet off the ground, she was hanging from a tree branch with a brown tube top. To police, there were no signs of a struggle, the grass wasn't disturbed like she had been dragged, there were no cuts, no bruises, and the medical examiner ruled her death a suicide. 25-year-old Margaret Fossey was returning home on January 16, 1982, following her time spent hanging out with her friends from Rice University. A brown Grand Prix trailed behind her. Carl's bright lights are very much on as he approaches her, and she ends up driving, puncturing 2 tires on the left side of her vehicle because she can't see. Margaret rolls the window down as Carl exits the vehicle, and Carl kills her with a single blow to the throat. He then places her body inside her trunk. Carl witnessed Julia Sanchez, who pulled over on the highway shoulder that same morning due to a flat tire. After approaching from behind, Carl slashes her throat twice, but she manages to live. On January 30th, 19-year-old Alice Martell pulls out of her Galveston Bay apartment. As she approaches the door, she gets stabbed once in the chin and again in the left chest, and she as well survived. 19-year-old Patty Johnson was attacked when she walked into her apartment in Galveston. The man tackled her to the ground, straddled her, and slashed her throat with a knife. A man on the second floor heard the commotion and yelled at the attacker, and the man fled. She survived as well and told police that the man was a black man, about 5'11 and 160 pounds. On February 7th, 20-year-old Elena Simander was visiting a friend in Houston when she was found strangled to death in a trash bin. On March 20th, 14-year-old Emily LaCroix recently moved from Seattle, Washington to Houston, Texas. She was last seen hitchhiking along Interstate 10, and people assumed that she ran away. 5 months later, her body was found stuffed inside a draining ditch. On March 27, 34-year-old Edith Ledet was stabbed 17 times in her chest while jogging. She was found on the sidewalk. On April 15, 21-year-old Yolanda Garcia was returning home from work when she was stabbed 4 times on her front lawn. On April 17th, 32-year-old Carrie Mae Jefferson was on the way home from work as she reached for her keys to unlock the door. Carl grabbed her from behind, placed a hand over her mouth, and drug her through the front yard. He grabbed her keys and threw her into the trunk. Her car was found the next day, where they found blood. On April 21st, 25-year-old Susan Searles was kidnapped on her way home from a party. Carl strangled her and held her head in a flower pot filled with water to make sure she was dead. Her body was buried in a vacant lot. 20-year-old Michelle Madej returned home around 4 in the morning on May 23rd, 1982, after celebrating a friend's birthday. Carl followed her, choked her, and threw her inside the apartment. He removed all her clothes and drowned her in the bathtub. He then went into her room and ransacked it. Less than 2 hours later, he attacked Melinda Aguilar and Lori Lester. 18-year-old Melinda Aguilar and 21-year-old Lori Lester had their apartments broken into. When he saw Lori coming home from work, he began strangling her. He took her into the apartment, where he also choked Melinda. Carl tied Melinda's hands behind her back as she pretended to pass out from him choking her. He carried Lori's body upstairs and filled the bathtub. Melinda was able to escape using the window and went to get help. Carl then saw two police officer cars outside and took off through the front door. Officers saw him and began to chase him. 23-year-old Patricia McDonald, their downstairs neighbor, ran upstairs to check on Melinda and Lori and found Lori submerged in the water. Lori's skin was turning blue and Patricia pulled Lori from the bathtub and began pounding her back. Lori began coughing up water and blood and was gasping for air. An officer chased Carl through the apartments and then ran after his car, which was parked near the police cruisers. Another officer noticed him next to his car, and Carl took off in another direction, which was a dead end. And that is when Carl was... Now that Carl was in police custody, they started to piece the puzzle pieces together and realized that he was the one behind the murders in Houston. Prosecutors, however, thought that there wasn't enough evidence to find him guilty. Carl accepted a plea deal from the DA in May 1982. Carl would only face charges of burglary with intent to murder if he admitted to his crimes. If he admitted to his crimes, then was granted immunity from prosecution regarding the murder charge, and he would also receive a 60-year sentence. Carl showed police the graves of 3 victims, Suzanne Searles, Carrie Johnson, and Emily LaCroix. He told them that he attacked 19 women and murdered 13 of them. Michigan did not have an immunity agreement like Texas, and they were not willing to make a deal. Due to the plea agreement, Carl was spared a trial even though he admitted to most of the murders. According to the Texas Court of Appeals, Carl was unaware that the bathtub and water that he attempted to drown Lori Lester in was regarded as a deadly weapon. Mind you, he also just admitted to attacking 19 women and murdering 13 of them, and they classified him as a nonviolent offender, or a felon. Now, Texas at the time permitted nonviolent offenders to subtract 3 days from their sentence for each day that they serve. That is if they behaved well. And Carl behaved well in prison, and he would have been free as early as May 9th, 2006. Now, the public was absolutely not going for this law. They found it absolutely ridiculous, and the law was abolished. In order to prove Carl guilty of murder, Michigan Attorney General Mike Cox pleaded with anyone who had information on the Michigan murders to come forward in 2004. One man spoke up, his name is Joseph Foy, who claimed to have witnessed a man who matched Carl Watts' description during the December 1st, 1979 murder of Helen Dutchner. He states, quote, "His eyes were evil and devoid of emotion." Again, there was no plea deal, so Michigan were going to bring Carl to trial for these murders. Prior to the start of his trial in 2004, law enforcement requested and the judge granted permission for the Texas confessions to be included into evidence. Carl Watts was charged with the murder of Helen Dutchner. On November 17, 2004, Carl was found guilty. He received a life sentence on December 7th. Authorities in Michigan started their efforts to find Carl guilty of killing Gloria Steele in 1974, 2 days later. On July 5, 2007, Carl's trial for Gloria's murder got underway in Kalamazoo, Michigan. The following day, on July 26, the jury found Carl guilty. Carl received a life sentence without the possibility of parole on September 13th, where he died on September 21, 2007 from prostate cancer. My thoughts? Well, Carl is an evil bastard, that's for sure. And it is crazy to... That's why I don't like plea deals. I don't like plea deals because Carl literally confessed to 13 murders in Texas and basically got away with it, only being convicted of burglary with an intent to kill. Michigan wasn't playing games, I can say that, when it came to this case. There is always this pattern that we see where someone has these dark fantasies, they get locked up for a year, and it's like, once they're out, it's like, time to kill people. There are so many cases that I have covered and that I just know where it's like, literally that, like, there is a warning sign, they're in prison for attacking a woman or something for 1 year, they get released early, and then that's when they start their murder spree. When they're conducting their investigation, a lot of people will say, we missed the warning signs. Every single time. I don't know how that happens, especially when there is like so much cases that you can refer to as examples. My heart goes out to all the victims and their families who have endured. And with that, today's episode comes to an end. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Remember, every Thursday there is a new episode. You can keep up with me and the podcast at Instagram at Criminal Curiosity Pod. Wow, plod. Pod. That is all that I have for you today. Please be safe out there. Look out for one another. Until next time. Bye, everyone.